Accession number 30639, Mr. Alan Davis, Route 7. Now, can you take me through your flying training as you remember it, starting with the steerman, the basic training, the steerman? So I presume you had to redo everything you'd done in the grading school, in the sense that wouldn't count, would it?
Yes, absolutely, because the grading school was just 10 hours to sort out who was going to be a pilot or not. When you started with a steerman, you learnt to fly, and you did all the standard things, climbing and descending and steep turns and so on. And looking back at my logbook, we only did, the steerman was called a PT-17A. That was its full title. And after the first hour of instruction, we did spinning.
Now tell me about spinning. We haven't done that.
No, we haven't never mentioned that so far. But spinning was, way back, was a very dangerous thing to get yourself into in an aeroplane. And till somebody discovered the almost infallible way of getting out of the spin. And because a spin was the worst thing that could happen to you when you were in the air, and you spun because you had run out of airspeed. So if you put the nose up too far and the airspeed just dropped off, one wing would drop on any aeroplane, this is, but the speeds vary. And any aeroplane, the wing drops and the thing goes into a spin, which means it's completely out of control. There's nothing you can do about it except get out of the spin first. So within the first hour of instruction, I see from my logbook, we did spinning. And so the instructor, in this case Mr. Worthen, would have shown you clearly how to get out of a spin. And
Now, how do you get out of a spin?
Well, you get out of a spin because if you're spinning to the right, it's full left rudder, and really you jam your left foot forward and you get full left rudder, and then push the joystick completely forward. So the rudder takes the rotation, the rotating part of the spin off, and the putting the stick forward puts the nose straight downwards. So you build up proper speed again, and then you're hurtling towards the ground. So you don't do this lower than, let's say, 5,000 feet, and preferably higher than that. So then you straighten out, level off, and you're back to normal. But you can tell when the aircraft's going to go into a spin with a decent, gentlemanly, or if you like, ladylike type of aeroplane, like the steerman and the tiger moth. It gives you lots of warning, in other words.
In what way?
It starts to shudder. It's obviously not happy in the attitude or the speed that it's going at. And then I said it drops a wing, and that's the start of the thing. But if you do that on a more advanced aeroplane, it doesn't give you any warning. It just goes, clicks into the spin, and it happens very quickly and without any warning. And this can happen, of course, when you can see the ground, and also when you're flying in cloud, which is much more difficult. But if you're flying in cloud and you should spin, if you go through the right drill, in other words, full opposite rudder and the stick completely right forward, it gets out, stops spinning, and so you can level off. But so you're taught at a very, this is the point of what I'm saying, this, you're taught this at a very, very early stage of your flying training. So after 1 hour, we were doing, with dual control, spins. And I see in the second hour that I flew, the following day, we did more spinning. But and then going back to my logbook, I see that I I went solo in a Stearman after 8.5 hours. So that was similar to the Tiger Moth. And I also see that I did 3 hours solo.
Do you remember your first solo? I mean, was that much more routine?
Much more routine, you know, having broken the... got over the first hurdle of the first being on your own in a plane. Now, going solo in a Stearman was a necessary hurdle again, but not anything like as demanding or noteworthy, in fact. So I went solo after 8.5 hours, and I see that after 3 hours of solo in a Stearman, I did my first... my first spin solo, so that's only after just 3 hours of solo, and after 60 hours of Stearman flying, we started doing night flying.
Now, had you done any? Well, now let's do night flying. So, tell me about night flying then.
Well, night flying, when you'd got familiarity with the type of plane you were flying, whether it was a Stearman or a Harvard or a Hurricane or a Spitfire, when you built up enough hours and confidence, in other words, ability, competency, you did this night flying. And night flying in America, on the Stearman, well, and later on, I suppose, in the Harvard, they didn't have any airfield lighting. It was all done by little, like Hurricane lamps, which were strung out down the runway in either a T shape or an L shape, I can't remember which. And you flew with these lights strung out in a line, which was the runway, which they made the runway in the desert sand, and you kept these on your left hand side. If the wind changed, then the layout of the runway had to be changed as well. So after 60 something hours, we started doing night flying, and we did a total of 70 hours on Stearman, on this PT-17A, and then we graduated from the basic training, as it was so called, to advanced training.
Now, had you started doing sort of aerobatics?
Oh, yes.
Now, tell me about the different things of aerobatics, because that's always interesting, though.
Well, we'd only mentioned spinning, because that's in my logbook, and the spinning has to be underlined in red ink. But as well as doing all that, we did aerobatics as became sort of almost the bread and butter part of flying. You did this when you'd done all the other exercises like forced landings, action in the event of fire, and restarting the engine in flight, and all that sort of those sort of drill things. The instructors say, "Right, owner, let's do some aerobatics," and we went through the usual pattern of what I now consider to be the usual pattern of loops and rolls.
Well, tell me, do you remember how you do some of these things? Well, the loop, that's a famous one, but I mean...
Well, I do indeed, because this is digressing, certainly, but for my 80th birthday, which was a few years ago now, I got given a flight in a Harvard, and we flew from Shoreham near Brighton, and at my request we did some aerobatics in this Harvard that they provided me with, and the instructor, again the English instructor, just two years ago, said, you know, would you like to do some aerobatics? Okay, I'll take you through one first. And so he stuffed the nose down, and we said, right, we build up the speed to 140 or perhaps 160 knots, and then ease the stick back, and this is exactly how we were taught all those years ago in Stearman's and Harvard and so on. And the great thing about a loop is that you line yourself up on something, and now at Shoreham it was the coastline, so you had the sea and the beach and land, so you line yourself up on this line of beach, if you like, which is a straight line, And the great thing is that when you start your dive, you go down towards this beach and pull up into the loop. And when you come out of the loop, you're still in line with the beach. In other words, you haven't veered right or left. And that's the only... that's the main criteria of doing a good loop. And later on, when we used to mess about trying to do aerobatics in formation, and that really is quite difficult.
I'll come back to it, because the formation we'll do... What other aerobatics? You mentioned...
Well, we did loops and what's called an Immelmann, which is a roll off the top of the loop. You go into the loop, and when you're upside down at the top of the loop, you roll and get the right way up, so you finish flying in the opposite direction to what you first started, which was the manoeuvre was invented by a German pilot in 1914-18 war as a combat manoeuvre. He was called Immelmann, so that's why it's still called an Immelmann. But in English, it's a roll off the top. And then we did barrel rolls, which are...
Which one of them?
Which is a very simple roll where you stick put the stick right over and the plane just rolls over in the shape of a barrel. In other words, it's a roll around a fairly wide diameter or arc or whatever, which is fairly simple. And a slow roll is much more difficult, because it's keeping the plane on a level axis, and the plane just turns over in a very narrow, much narrower axis. And it's much more difficult to do, because when the plane is on its side, the elevators on rudder work in opposite directions. And when it's on its side, if you use your rudder to keep the nose up, not to turn the aeroplane. So all these things you learn at a very early stage of flying. And when you first do it, obviously they are very ragged and hardly recognisable, probably, as manoeuvres. But the more you practice and the more hours you've accumulated, the better you get at it, or we hope you do.
What about the forced landing? What are you looking for in a forced landing? Because it's a drill, isn't it?
It's a drill, yeah. Well, in most forms of dual instruction, you are taken off and you said, right, we're going to try a forced landing. So at a point which is only determined by the instructor, he cuts your engine and says, right, your engine has failed, make a forced landing. So you have to assess which way the wind is blowing down on the ground. If somebody has kindly lit a bonfire close by, it's ideal. And if the instructor knows what he's doing, he's probably spotted one that you could observe if you were wide enough awake. And then you have to spot which way the wind is blowing. Then you have to pick a field which is landable in. In other words, not amongst trees or perhaps bushes, and a grass field if you can, a ploughed one if you can't, and growing crops if all else fails. But if you're very lucky and you have to do a forced landing, if you pick a really big grass field, you can land with wheels down, or with steerman, which was Tiger Moth, which is fixed undercarriage. You land on a grass field, so that you don't stick the wheels into mud and turn over onto your nose, or worse still, onto your back. Because if you turn over onto your back, you're upside down, all the petrol starts leaking out of the places where, for example, the petrol filler. And there's always a danger of fire, so that's the thing to be aware of. And so, during early stages of instruction, you are taught how to prepare for and be not too put out by the occasion when your engine might fail. in the flying experience I had, which wasn't very long, I only had one occasion when I had an engine failure, which that was on a Spitfire, so mm-hmm. I'll tell you about that later on.
Now, what about formation flying?
Well, formation flying...
Or would that come later?
Well, certainly much later.
Let's see.
Yeah, but certainly much later.
What about instrument flying? I mean, because you mentioned night flying, but what about blind flying, or what do they call it, instrument flying?
Yes. Well, quite early on in the... I'm just trying to look through my logbook to find out... Instrument flying seemed to start after about 20 hours, 15 or 20 hours.
Now, can you explain what it means?
Well, an aircraft has some basic instruments. Even the present day sophisticated airplanes will have four or five, whatever it is, basic instruments. A speed indicator, a altimeter, which measures your height above sea level, a turn and bank indicator, and a climbing or descent instrument, which tells you whether you're going slightly up or slightly down. And with the five of, oh, and a compass, is that five? With those instruments, you should be capable, or you probably are capable if you're an experienced flyer, of flying without being able to see the ground at all. So the way they did it, even in a steerman at this early stage of flying training, you have a hood affair which you pull up from behind you, and it's a canvas hood which just cuts out any sight of land. And you are taught how to fly on instruments. You also get, at the same time, you have linked trainer instruction, which you'll sit in a dummy aircraft plane on the ground, which is on a pivot, and it has the same instruments and reacts in the same way as a normal airplane, but it's completely safe because it's just a model airplane stuck on the ground with hydraulic connections that make the aeroplane react by banking or looping, banking or nose dive or nose down or nose up.
It's a simulator.
A simulator, and that, in the first thing, link trainer we sat in was literally a box with these five instruments in it, and it's just a dummy aeroplane. You climb in, and you pull the hood up again so that you can't see outside, and it gets us hotter than hell in it, because in Arizona, you can imagine, the outside temperature is goodness knows how high, and then you sit in this little wooden box with a canvas hood over you, and it gets stinkingly hot. However, that's how you learn to read these instruments. And you have an instructor, of course, in the aeroplane, an instructor sitting at a table with a link trainer, and he can tell you A, the things he wants you to do, and B, the things you are doing wrong. So that's how you learn to fly on instruments. And as in all things, some people are better at it than others.
How are you at it?
Very, very mediocre. I passed. I did everything I had to do, but I was never very, very good at it. Some people were absolutely excellent. They interpreted the instruments and they reacted correctly and so on. But if you think about the long-distance bomber raids that occurred for others later in the war or during this period, there would be for several hours they'd be flying, blind flying. It's truly the bombers had automatic pilots which they could log on to and take the strain out of actually flying the aeroplane. But you still would have had to watch the instruments to make sure that the automatic pilot was doing what it should do. But we got taught about instrument flying quite early in the flying routine. So we learned on the steerman's, and we did exactly the same routine in the Harvard later on.
Now, anything else? What about assessment? How was the assessment done? Because you have various tests, don't you?
Yes.
Or with the flying instructor, the flying instructor, the flight
commander. Well, the flight commander, that's right. Well, I see after about 20 hours, I've got in my logbook here, the first air check. And so I got taken up by who was the flight commander, a chap called Hansen, I see in my logbook on the steerman, the B stage check at about 15 to 20 hours. And then I had two checks on the same day. I don't know quite why, but...
These nerve-wracking, because I presume if you messed them up too much, you'd be off.
Oh, yes, they were very practical exams, and the pressure was very considerable because, as you said, if you didn't pass, I guess you'd have be given another chance, but depending on how bad you were, I mean, if you were really useless, you should have been sorted out a long time ago. But if you had just one particular failing, they would tell you what it was and give you a chance to practice to overcome it. The only real hurdle that I can recall in my flying training altogether was my conversion afterwards from the steerman to the Harvard, and the Harvard has a retractable undercarriage, and I just, for some reason or other, I could not get the retractable undercarriage into my cockpit drill. I would be forever taking off and forgetting to raise the wheels. Fortunately, I never forgot to put them down again on landing, but again, that was correct drilling and good instruction, I guess. But that was the only little hurdle I came across. And as soon as I overcame that, and I had to be taken up, I remember, by one of the flight commanders to check this fault that they had discovered in my flying ability. And he checked me out, and finally I was able, you know, I convinced him, I was able to persuade him that I'd got that part of the drill taped, and I didn't forget it, or I didn't do it wrongly at the wrong time.
What about cross-country exercises and navigation? We haven't really covered that yet. Was that later in the Harvard?
No. I think we had it in the steerman as well. I'm just looking quickly through my logbook. I hadn't checked on that.
What were the exercises like? I presume it's pretty deserty around there.
Yes, it is. Well, I see after, again, about 30 hours, 25, 30 hours, we started doing cross countries, and it's recorded here as pilot navigation, and we flew from Falcon Field, which is where the number 4 BFTS was called, Falcon Field, to
Falcon Field's Mesa.
Yes, correct. Sorry, I should have made that clear earlier on. And we flew from Falcon Field to a place called Casa Grande, so it was a spot picked out on the map. And if it was pilot navigation, you were in the aeroplane and then told to plot a course for something somewhere on the map. Let's take this place, Casa Grande, wherever that was. So you had to, we had a map, and you had to either somehow decide what course to steer and how to lay off if you had a wind of blowing from east or west or north or whatever, how to lay off wind drift so that you compensated for wind drift. And all this had to be done, as it were, in the head,
How did you do that? I mean, because I know a lot of pilots just follow roads and railways and yes. cheat. I mean, but in the desert, that's not necessarily that easy. Did you actually have to develop navigational skills, proper navigational skills, as opposed yes. to reading maps? In other words, using, as you said, wind drift, the triangle of velocities, I think they call it. Yes,
I think they do.
Did you have to learn all that?
Well, you learned it at ground school first, so you knew what you were trying to do, and it's only a question of interpreting it in the air. But I'm perhaps a bit ahead of myself. With the steerman, I think you would have had a map, and you would have had your course laid out with a pencil marked between the two places, and you would have been able to read with a protractor the number of degrees to steer, and so all you would have to do was to lay off the, as you rightly call it, triangle of velocities, the wind direction and how it was going to affect your ground speed. So you'd have done that on the ground, and it was just a question of applying it in the air with a steerman. As you got more advanced, certainly, you know, after leaving this Mesa or the Falcon Field altogether, certainly pilot navigation became a much more refined art. But you cross countries, so after 30 or 40 hours flying, you started doing cross countries. And later on, when we flew to Harvard, we actually got the big test was a 1,000-mile cross country, which we flew somewhere, stayed overnight, and flew back again.
Do you remember that at all?
Well, yes. We did it in pairs of cadets. We didn't do it under dual instruction or anything. So two cadets would fly. One would fly from A to B, and the other would fly from B back to A again. And we had to prepare a flight plan and work out how long it would take and so on. And we were flying over territory which we had, and this is in Arizona again, over territory which we were not familiar with. And we were told we were landing at an airfield at whatever it was called. I could look it up, but it doesn't really
matter.
Which would be 500 miles away from Phoenix. And it was not unknown for chaps to land on the wrong airfield. That was part of the exercise, to identify the airfield. In the UK, it was much more straightforward. There were many more airfields, of course, closer together. And it was ever so easy to get confused between airfields. But in the signal square, there was a code letter in this country to identify an airfield. But on this 1,000-mile cross country in Arizona, it was a great event to land on a strange airfield anyway, particularly with other aeroplanes using the runways. I mean, we didn't have any runways at Phoenix. There was just a desert. Flat as a pancake. But when we landed on runways for the first time, that was really quite a step up. But that's how you learned. You did progressively. You just went further and further into the complexities, if you like to call it that, of flying from A to B and back again, and being able to land the thing when you got there.